I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our Patreon sponsors. If you'd like to become a Patreon sponsor for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, please go to our official website, bodybuildinglegendshow.com, and you'll see the link in the upper right-hand corner for becoming a Patreon member. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding. We also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we're going to have part two of our interview with Nicholas Kemla, who is the author of a new book about Mike Mentzer called Mr. America. It is now available on Amazon. It was written in 2019 in France, because Nicholas is from France, and they just translated it into English. So it is now available for everyone in America to read, and it is a great book. I've been reading it all week since Nicholas gave me a copy, and it's really, really a great book. It's 600 pages long, and it's written like a novel. It's not just a regular biography of somebody. It's written very exciting, like a novel, and Nicholas is a great writer. This was his first book, so he did a fantastic job. And so we had part one of our interview with Nicholas last week, so we will continue today with part two of our interview. And after our interview is over, don't leave. Stick around, because I'm going to read two articles. First one is called Mike Mentzer, a Future Superstar, and Nicholas mentioned this article in part one of our interview. This was in the January 1976 issue of Muscle Builder magazine. I made a mistake. I actually thought Mike's first article ever was in the April 1976 issue, where he did an interview with Gene Mosè, and he talked about his unique training style where he did very low volume. But I believe this was actually the first interview ever done with Mike. It's called Mike Mentzer, a Future Superstar. It's written by Armand Tanney, as Nicholas mentioned last week in the interview. So I have this article as well. So I'm going to read this week. And then Nicholas gave me permission to read a little excerpt from his book, Mr. America. So the part I picked out was where Mike went to the 1965 Mr. Olympia contest in Brooklyn, New York, and he got to meet Dave Draper and Larry Scott. So I'm going to read a couple of pages of that. So this will give you an example of how the book is written. And I'm telling you guys, you got to really check this book out. If you're a Mike Mentzer fan, or if you're just a bodybuilding fan, it's really, really well written. So check it out. It is on Amazon, and I will put the link below so you guys can just click on that and order it very conveniently. All right. What else is going on? We got the Mr. Olympia coming up, the 60th Mr. Olympia coming up, speaking of the Olympia, and that will be in Las Vegas this year. I am planning on going. I just made my reservations for my hotel and my airfare this week. So it should be a really exciting event. Should be here before you know it. October 11th and 12th, that weekend. So it's about 5 weeks away. So it'll be here quick. Looks like Hunter Labrada just won a pro contest today out in Italy. So he is now qualified for the Olympia. So he'll be out there. And it's going to be a really, really spectacular show. So I'm looking forward to going out there. I haven't been to Vegas in quite a while. Quite a few years. So it should be interesting. Good time of the year, too, October. It won't be too hot and it won't be cold. Like last year, I believe it was in December, or no, not last year, the year before, it was in December, so it was really, really cold that year. All right, I got a couple emails from you guys. If you guys are interested in emailing about the show, just send it to naturalolympia@gmail.com. This first one says, "Hey, John, fantastic part one interview with Nicholas Kemla. I bought the Mr. America book instantly, since I always love anything Mike Mentzer. Nicholas really seems to know his bodybuilding history, which is fantastic. And I do look forward to reading his book and seeing what more he will put together in the future. When I heard about the magazine place in San Francisco, I was immediately thinking of driving over there this weekend, since San Francisco is only about a 3-hour drive for me. But sadly, it says that place is permanently closed. Bummer. San Francisco has been hit harder than most big cities in recent years, and a lot of great content from there has fallen by the wayside. A future guest that may be a fun bodybuilding discussion of all sorts of good old history would be Juan Carlos Cassano, the golden era bookworm. He has always deep dived into bodybuilding history and has built his own Vince Gironda inspired old school gym. I feel that could make for a solid historical conversation. I look forward to part two with Nicholas Kemla and reading some Mike Mentzer and Mr. America. Who knows, maybe a heavy-duty biopic could be on the horizon. Also looking forward to your new book, John. Until then, I'll keep on training hard and staying strong. Sincerely, Spencer Scott Holmes, that pizza boy comics guy, and Thor's Hidden Gem. All right, thank you, Spencer. Yeah, I did reach out to Juan Carlos like a year or two ago, and he couldn't make it on the show, so I haven't talked to him since. But yeah, I could try reaching out to him again. And that really sucks about that place closing down. I was thinking about going out there after I talked to Nicholas last week. But yeah, it doesn't surprise me. San Francisco was really hit hard by the pandemic, and so I'm not surprised it's gone. I did look up the magazine on Facebook, and they do still have a Facebook page. They even have a phone number, and I tried calling the number. I guess they don't answer phone calls, but they do listen to the messages. So I sent them an email. I just asked them what happened to all the magazines that were in there. I hope they didn't get rid of them. I hope they stored them somewhere. I haven't heard back from them since, but if I hear from them, I will let you guys know. But that really sucks. I was really excited about that place too after Nicholas mentioned it. I got another email here. John, I thoroughly enjoyed part one of this interview. What an interesting and creative person Nicholas is. A pleasure to listen to. His question of what does it tell us about ourselves that a society would reward person and their set of ethics over another is so well stated. And how I felt as I watched not only Arnold train in the summer of 1980, no one knowing he was going to compete, and then the bitter aftermath in the gym after the charade went down in Sydney. Looking forward to part two and purchasing the book today to read Kemla's prose. Thanks for the podcast, Mark Martinez. All right. Thank you, Mark. Good to hear from you. All right, guys. Well, we got kind of a long show with these two articles I'm going to read. So let's get to part two of our interview with Nicholas Kemla, who is the author of the book Mr. America, a novel about Mike Mentzer. Here we go.
And so they took him and another of his friends. There was a younger guy that trained with Mike and Mike's father's friend. And they went to the 1965 Olympia. And
that's, yeah, I wanted to talk about that, yeah.
Ah, okay, cool. Yeah, that's something I wanted to mention because, again, it's I think it's a big part of the first part of the book because it was a major event in bodybuilding's history, but also in Mike's own history because he managed to sneak into the backstage and meet Larry Scott and Dave Draper.
Yeah.
Who were both on stage at the time, both won Dave Draper, Mr. America, Larry Scott, the first Mr. Olympia ever. And I mean, again, you can imagine, I mean, Mike was not even 15, sorry, my accent is sometimes a little bit wrong.
Yeah.
15. He was just a kid. And so he's there facing all of a sudden in this tiny little storage room with Dave Draper and Larry Scott, who just got back from being on stage. And, you know, for 2-3 years, he's been seeing their pictures in the magazines and going like, oh, one day I'm going to look like them. And it's just it's just one of those episodes that when you read, when you align them all in front of you, you put them all in front of you and you go like, wow, that is a story that I want to tell, you know, because there are so many such episodes in Mike's life that are just like, as you say, bigger than life, you know, it's just, it's something that I would do. I would not sneak backstage to talk to my wife.
Right.
I was 13 or 14 years old.
Didn't he tell them he wanted to win Mr. America?
I might have made that up.
I just read that part today.
I have written it down, but I think that's what he said. I think, I mean, most of the things are right. Again, they've been published before. So if I write it, it must have been that I read it somewhere.
Yeah, I just read that.
I'm sorry, I wrote it 7 years ago. So I'm a bit confused in...
I did read that part in your book where Mike told him he wanted to be Mr. America. And I think Dave told him, he goes, no, you got to be Mr. Olympia. There's Mr. Olympia now, you know. And then,
yeah, because that was the new thing. And so 1965, the first Mr. Olympia is Joe Wheeler, big gamble on the future. And, you know, there's this whole, I mean, of course, I imagine your viewers and listeners are familiar with the Bob Hoffman versus Joe Wheeler war.
Yeah.
Strength and Health magazine and Muscle Builder, later Muscle and Fitness, you know, two completely different worldviews, again, like Mike and Schwarzenegger. Yeah. And again, And that's how the book and Mike's story talks of American history, because basically what that war talks about is this, the shift from the East Coast culture of America, American East Coast culture, which is very military, industrial, making things, you know, science, university, first settlers, pioneers, you know, and so Bob Hoffman, basically, you know, strong, rigid, serious.
Right.
It's not about fun. It's about fighting for the greater good. And then little by little, in the second half of the 20th century, American culture switches from that, which suddenly becomes kind of like old and boring and gray and to the West Coast culture, which is Hollywood, bimbos, you know, muscle on the beach. And it's a completely different approach. And so, so Bob Hoffman, Joe Wheeler, and Joe Wheeler is fighting. His big fight is to outmoded Bob Hoffman and to claim the crown of the muscle king, or the king of the muscle world. And so we're not going to go into the details, but there was a lot of things that were wrong with the AAU in the way they did the bodybuilding contest.
Absolutely.
They had a very old school view of bodybuilding was kind of like the bad smaller brother of weightlifting. So and Joe Wheeler wanted to change that, because Joe Wheeler understood that the youth culture, the new baby boomers culture of America, all these kids born after the war, they were embracing this culture of, you know, body beautiful, freedom of the body, you know, showing more skin. And Joe Wheeler had that understanding. And so he said, we got to get rid of all that, you know, bullshit of Hoffman and the military industrial complex. And then they want fun. They want superheroes. They want, you know, big bimbo guys with girls at their feet posing on the beach.
And
his big gamble was say, okay, I'm gonna create a new title, Mr. Olympia, that's gonna bring everyone together. You know, enough with the Mr. This and Mr. That. Mr. Olympia is going to be the biggest crown in the bodybuilding world. And so he organized it in the Brooklyn Academy of Music, which is an amazing building. I mean, I imagine you've been there. It's very classical. It's very, very imposing, but it's more attuned to, you know, opera or high culture, quote unquote, events, you know, theater and drama. And there you have it in 1965, black leather jacket crowds, you know, like all these kind of like street kids who like bodybuilding and superheroes already at the time. And, you know, and they storm into that very classical building to watch the, and if you, I mean, of course you've read Muscle Wars by Ricky Wayne, but the way he describes that event was very inspiring for me. And, you know, I mixed it up with other sources, but I think it was a night to remember. And I think it's amazing to have, you know, kids today who can read that and realize what craziness it was at the time to have an event like that for bodybuilding.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about John Ziegler. Now, John Ziegler was the one who brought Diana Ball into the culture, and he was connected with the weightlifting world. And you write about him in the book, right, Nicholas?
Well, so not only I write about him because he played a big role in the history of the sport, bodybuilding, and all the sport, because, as you said, he introduced testosterone and Diana Ball. So that's the first reason. Second reason, he was another bigger-than-life character. And that's one thing about that book and Mike's story and the way I weave all those stories together, is that all these guys, when you dive into their lives, whether it's Bob Hoffman, Joe Wheeler, Doug Ziegler, Arthur Jones, and of course Mike and Arnold, you know, I mean, all these guys are so much like bigger-than-life characters that you wouldn't even believe it. Like, if you were told today that there's a guy like that, I mean, maybe you could compare them to like the Elon Musk or Zuckerberg or Trump, actually.
Or Trump,
You know what I mean? These guys were just like so much bigger than that. And so Ziegler was like that. So when I again I dove into the online world and written resources like Randy Roach's book and Ziegler was just like a completely crazy character. Like he was huge, very tall, very big.
Oh really? Yeah, I didn't know that.
Well, I mean, he wasn't like fit in a bodybuilding fit, but
yeah,
he was
but he's
really
a big man.
Tall.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, very imposing. I think you, I mean, I don't know my feet and my inches, so I'm not gonna,
right.
But anyway, yeah, he was very, very imposing physically. He had a booming voice. He'd been through everything. He'd been to the war. He'd fought in the war. He traveled the whole world. And he was a big drinker. So yeah, he was part of the, it was actually Grimek, John Grimek, another, even older, but in golden era champion, amazing guy, an amazing physique. I mean, to me, in my view, to that day, there's never been a comparable physique to that of Grimek. But anyway,
yeah.
Ziegler met Grimek a little bit by chance at a gym when Ziegler was recruiting, what do you call them, guinea pigs, like lab rats for his own. Experimenting with testosterone. And so he met Grimek by chance, and then Grimek introduced Ziegler to the York again, Bob Hoffman, and Strength and Health, and so all the weightlifting Olympics team. And Ziegler went to Russia for the Olympics, and he talked with the doctor of the Russian team, not the Russian, the Soviet team. At the time it was Soviet. And the doctor, told Ziegler, he said, well, I think my guys, they're that strong because they take this and that. And anyway, and then the third reason why I write about Ziegler is that he played a major role in my life. And that's something I didn't know.
Didn't know that either. No.
When I talk about East Coast versus West Coast, and of course, that, but I think for people who don't know, we don't necessarily realize how much of a small, corner of the United States, I mean, that you could call maybe New England, or, I mean, basically that whole part, between Philadelphia, Springfield, York, and there was so much going on in terms of weightlifting, bodybuilding, the science of it. And so it was, I mean, all those towns were, and cities were not that far away from each other, so all
right.
Those guys like knew each other, and so Mike somehow going to work to York met with Ziegler when he was pretty young still, and so possibly Ziegler prescribed steroids to him. And
how old was Mike at the time, Nicholas?
I don't really remember. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I did like 7 years ago.
18,
19? A little younger than that.
Oh, younger. Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. I will have to. 16, basically. Maybe 17. I'm sorry. I don't want to say something wrong. And it's a long way back in.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was pretty young. But I mean, again, it was not that extraordinary at the time. And Schwarzenegger started taking steroids when he was 13. And again, I'm not the one covering that. It's been written many times before from trustworthy sources. So I don't think it was that, extraordinary. But what's interesting is that Mike meets again Ziegler a few years later in, I think, 1971. And Ziegler at the time had taken his distance with steroids. He was afraid of the creature he'd created, because it had become such an epidemic of steroids abuse that Ziegler kind of like stepped away from it, and he'd started working on the Isotron. Have you ever heard of the Isotron?
Is that a machine?
Yeah, the electro-stimulating machine.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Mike worked with Ziegler on the Isotron for a few months when he was a student or in between studies. And he and Ray, Mike's brother, They were the operators of the Isotron for Ziegler's clients. So a lot of them were athletes that had been injured or they wanted to try a new way to train. And so that was an important time in Mike's life because he didn't really know where he was going at the time. He'd injured himself in 1970, 71. He had a major shoulder injury, which kept him away from training for a few months. He should have gotten surgery, but he didn't because he didn't have the financial means. And so there was a bit of like a patchy period in his life where he didn't really know what to do. And Ziegler picked him up and said, "Well, come with me, work with me. I'm going to put you back on your feet." And he started the whole machine going. And also, Ziegler mentioned to Mike a few writers that were very influential in Mike's thinking. One of them, a guy that's mostly forgotten now called Zellier, who wrote on the stress adaptation syndrome, which is a major part of Mike's theory of muscle building, that your body adapts to under stress. And that's how you build muscle. And that's why you need to train intensely and very hard, because otherwise you don't create that stress situation that's gonna trigger muscle growth. So it's Tigger who mentioned Zellier to Mike. Yeah. And he also mentioned another guy, a Japanese writer called Mishima, who was a novelist and a poet and also a politician. And Mishima had he played a major role in Mike's view of the world, in the sense that Mishima also, like Mike, even though he was not a bodybuilding champion, but he did lift weights, and he had this idea that the body and mind could work together. The training of the body was a training for the mind, and the training and having a well structured or science-based mind helps you train your body better. And again, those are things that in Mike's early adulthood, when he was a little bit not really sure which direction to go, that played a major role, that you keep finding in his writing all the way through towards to the end of his life. So a lot of people talk about Ayn Rand and how, I mean, she was a major influence on Mike's thinking, but she only came out much later, like in the late 70s, early 80s. Before that, there was all these writers that Ziegler introduced Mike to that you keep finding in his writing all the way to the end.
Talk a little bit about Mike's period from like 1971 to 75, because he was kind of off the bodybuilding competitive scale then, right? And didn't he try to go to medical school at that time?
So that's what I was the things that I've just said, they happen between
During that
in
time.
the periods 71, 74. He doesn't really know where to go. Ziegler meets again with him because again they all live, not too far away from each other. All the guys go on to one another's gym, and Ziegler puts him back on his feet, not just with training and the Isotron and also, just woke up, but also with these writers that, because again, Mike was a very, you could say, brainy guy. I mean, his fire was in his brain more than in his body. And so reading those guys that I've just mentioned, they really triggered his, again, they rekindled the fire in his mind of going like, okay, I have a mission for the world. There is something I need to achieve. And I'm gonna achieve it, and it's in that period. So there's an episode in the book where Dave goes to visit Mike in I think it was Washington, and Mike is staying with Ray and two other friends, and they go. It's in 1972, and they go to the Rolling Stones concert on the 4th of July. It's one of the biggest tours, rock and roll tours in history. The Rolling Stones at the time are regarded as the most dangerous band in the world. they because there's been so much going on in their tools, drugs and sex and
Right.
riot and everything. There's been the tour before that is when there was this black kid who got
Ultima, yeah.
Altamont, yeah.
Yeah.
The black kid got stabbed and killed or murdered. So it was a major tour. And Dave at the time works for the National Guard, and not works for, but he's with the National Guard, and
Yeah.
he's stationed near where Mike lives. And so they decide to go together to the tour. And so the way Dave told me that story and that I tell in the book, it was Mike was not in a very good place at that time. Like, it was obvious that he was kind of like he wasn't really sure what to do with his life. He was studying for a pre-med, but he had kind of like lost the motivation for that because, again, of writers that he read at the time who were questioning the whole psychiatry approach. They said that madness was a social construct, and that there was a lot of things going on in Mike's head. And so they go to the tour, and it's a major night in their life. They lose the car. They can't remember where they've parked the car afterwards. They have to stay on the parking lot for hours while everyone walks out. It's like 30,000 to 40,000 people. And it's the Independence Day. It's the 4th of July. There's fireworks. It's I mean, people who've read that part, they remember it as a very beautiful part of Mike's life and his friendship with Dave too, because that's another big part of the book is the friendship with Dave, I think, is interesting. Because Dave was always the guy who was not, he didn't have, how can I say, Dave was happy with what he got. You know what I mean? Like, so of course he wanted, he would have wished to actually win, and he did early in his career, but major titles later on. But what I mean in when I say that, I mean that Mike was really, he was more like the dreamer. Mike was the guy who always thought what more could be achieved and how much further you could go. And Mike was driven by this, fire for intensity and truth and and Dave, and it, in the story, when you have two guys like that, two friends like that, where one is just, the nice, he's really nice, very, very sweet, and he's more in many ways he's wiser, because Mike's passion for the truth and the ideal, that took him against the wall. You know what I mean? And so when you look at life, from a little bit of a distance, and you go like, well, I mean, wouldn't have you been happier if you'd been a little bit less intense, a little bit more satisfied with, okay, I've done my part, I've won my titles. Let's, move on and do something else. You know what I mean? Like,
Dave was in that 65 Mr. America, the one that Mike saw with the Olympia, yeah.
absolutely. Yeah, that's how they became friends.
Oh, that's how they
Mike,
became friends? Okay,
Mike was in the audience, and he was already, I mean, as I explained in the book, he'd been training for 2 years, started really early at 11. He was passionate about it. That was his big thing. The adults, his father's friends, they take him to New York and to Brooklyn. He's in the audience, and so before he sleeps backstage after the show, while he's in the audience, he sees Dave on stage, the youngest contestant for Mr. America ever. Dave is 15 years old, and when you look at the picture, it's stunning. It's like literally, it's unbelievable to see such a physique on such a young kid. I mean, it's and Mike goes like, oh wow, okay, so I can do that, because Mike is a little younger, but he goes like, oh, I don't have to wait like 10 years to look like that. It is absolutely possible. And so they didn't meet at the Olympia, but Mike found, I mean, again, it's a small
Small
world,
community,
but the whole region. So Mike knew, because the MC told during the evening that Dave was trained by Ed Jubenville, who was also a big name of the strength world from way back when. So Mike found Ed Jubinville's address in Strength and Health, because I don't know, there was like an ad or something, or and so he wrote to Dave via Ed Jubinville, and he wrote him a letter. He said, "Hey, I saw you at the Olympia. It's amazing. I want to look like you. I want to be your friend. You're going to teach me everything you know." And that's how it started. And I mean, really, their friendship, I find it very moving, because it's a friendship that lasted their whole life. Like, there was just a little part of Mike's life when he started really like falling apart in the late 80s, where they kept apart. But it was just a few years. Aside from that, between when they're 14, 15 years old up until Mike's death, they've remained very good friends, and they're very different personalities, but they're both animated by the same passion and the same love for progress, what America stood for at the time. And Steve Reeves, of course, and it's so moving. And when I met Dave the first time, I mean, you have to imagine, you're Dave Mastorakis, the champion from the old days. You live in your little house, and you get an email from a French guy who you've never heard of, who's never written a book before, and the guy is me. And I wrote Dave, and I said, "Hello, da da da. I want to write about Mike Menzer. I've heard you were a good friend. Would you want to talk?" And he actually invited me over, to his house, and
Oh,
we spent,
wow. Okay.
we spent 2 weeks, and literally every day, he spent hours with me going through his memories.
Wow.
And the way, and he was very moved, and it was very moving for me, but he was very moved just remembering that. And he was so, and he still is so sad about, what happened to Mike. It was very moving for me. I mean, there were some times when I was literally crying.
Wow, no
Just,
kidding.
just because it's such a beautiful, I mean, again, and I'm probably a bit more of a sensitive guy, you could say. I had tears in my eyes, just the strength of their friendship and going through the decades, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. And we trained together, so he put me through the high intensity training. I did a few sessions with him, and I mean, he's such a great guy, and I'm forever thankful to that he has agreed to, as I said, open the door to a completely unknown foreign guy out of the blue. So that
That's
speaks to
awesome.
the greatness of the guy that he is.
Another significant part in Mike's life was the 71 America when he met Arthur Jones and then Casey Viator, who was the winner of the contest.
Yes, absolutely. Arthur Jones is, I mean, you could write a whole
Book about
novel
him, yeah, for sure.
on Arthur Jones, which actually he has already. I mean, there's two. Arthur Jones wrote his own autobiography called "And God Laughs," which is available online. I mean, at least it
Oh,
was.
thank God that. Okay.
Oh yeah. I mean, it was in 2017, 18 when I was writing the book. I imagine that it's still available, even though it might have been taken out because, I mean, talk about bad mouthing Arnold. Like,
Oh, really?
I actually quote, I quote what Arthur wrote about Arnold as a quote from Arthur, and I'm safe because it's a quote from Arthur. It's not me saying it, but he goes like really all out on how
Is that book still available, or do they take it away?
it was in 2018 or
It was.
2019. I imagine it still is. So Arthur Jones was another bigger than life character. I mean, did you know that he started producing and directing a TV show where he was fighting animals in the wild
I remember that.
in foreign countries, like faraway countries? So, I mean, that tells you already a little bit of the guy. And he was a self-taught completely self-taught, very very aggressive, very intense, and passionate about strength and muscle and masculinity, and all these things were in his head all associated. And he started, designing this new approach. And he was like, there is something wrong in the way people train. It shouldn't be. Like, he saw the wider inflation in every sense of the world of, get ever bigger, train ever longer, and he was like, that doesn't make sense. So he started putting together the tenets of his high intensity training. But he also designed, the Nautilus, the of the machine that completely changes the approach. And again, we were saying earlier that most people in every community, bodybuilding and every other community, don't challenge the way people think or the things people do. They're just like, well, people have always done that. This is the way things are done. So why question it? Jones went as far as saying even a bicep curl doesn't make sense. Because he said, the way physics work, the gravity is vertical.
Distance falls off,
So he said that the point of tension is only like maybe 10 degrees of the whole, 130 degrees of the movement. So basically, all the 110 degrees left are useless. I'm putting it in a bit more simple than he actually phrases it, but that was. I'm just saying he went as far as to challenge something as basic and as self-evident as an arm curl. And so in 1970, he introduced the Blue Monster, the first machine that he designed, which was literally a monster. It was huge, shiny metal blue, and people were just like, what is that? They've never seen anything like that. And you have to realize that, I mean, and of course, but machines were not that popular at the time. Like, people train more with bars and dumbbells, but training with machines was not that popular at the time. So you had this huge machine, and he was looking for a champion that would really, I mean, as you say, once you have a guy with a physique to, embody, literally embody your training philosophy, people take you a bit more seriously. So he was looking for a guy, and he met Casey Viator, I think, in 1970. And so they came back 1 year later in 1971, and that's when Viator won the Mr. America. He was the youngest Mr. America winner ever. And Mike was competed in that contest. And he placed 10, I think,
Yes, 10.
but he won best legs and best arms, which is, not negligible. When he'd only he had only had three contests. He was only his third contest. He'd only gone back to training for a few months because of the shoulder injury. He'd stayed away from the gym. And so he placed 10th. Is not, you could say, well, it's not that good, but best legs and best arms. And he was, again, like Casey, he was 19. So, sorry. He met Casey Viator that night. And Casey, they connected. They were both the youngest contestants.
Same age,
They were both, mastodon compared to the other guys. They already both had that higher order physique. And so, of course, they connected. And Casey said, well, you should call that guy. And he gave Arthur Jones' name to Mike, number, name and number to Mike. And Mike left a message, and he never heard back. I mean, he didn't hear back for a while. And then one night, in the middle of the night, literally in the middle of the night, the phone rings, and Arthur starts screaming at him because he never spoke in a calm way. He was very intimidated. And he started explaining Mike the whole revolution of how to train. Mike went down to Florida sometime later to train with Arthur. And I mean, it was a big that's another thing I think that speaks to Mike's greatness, or the integrity, the honesty. Like, in every one of his writing, especially the books that he published later in his life about heavy duty, his own, version of high intensity training. He always explained that he owed the basis to Arthur Jones. A lot of the guys, and you know that better than me, a lot of the guys who write, especially at the time, maybe now it has changed, I don't know, but for a long time, a lot of the guys who wrote book about their own training philosophy, they never quoted their mentors. They always, they always pretended that
They had
they
been,
came up with it themselves. And Mike could easily have everyone believe that he had invented the whole thing, because when he publishes Heavy Duty in the mid 90s, I mean, Arthur Jones is almost completely forgotten. You know what I mean? But that's not the type of guy that Mike was. He explained that, Arthur Jones had laid the basis and he built on them. Just like Dorian Yates, explained that he evolved heavy duty in his own blood and guts training
Mentor.
methods, but he has the guts and the honesty to say, I learned the basics from Mike, and it was an inspiration for me, and I took it further and improved on it. But I think that speaks a lot to the type of guys that they are.
Let's talk a little bit about Mike's relationship with Joe Leader, because after the 1980 Olympia, the feeling was that Joe kind of pushed Mike out of the business because, he was speaking badly about the 1980 Olympia and they didn't want that kind of, talk. So they kind of pushed him out. But in the beginning, I mean, Joe was the one who offered Mike a job, and then Mike moved all the way from the East Coast to the West Coast to California. And he was, the managing editor or the editor in chief, I believe, of Muscle and Fitness, or I'm not sorry, a Muscle Builder magazine. And he was writing all those articles. I mean, that's when I was into bodybuilding. That's when I first started. So I would read Mike's articles every month. And like you said, he was a great writer. And most of those bodybuilders had their articles ghostwritten by other writers, but Mike was actually writing his own stuff. So it seemed like Joe had a real affinity for Mike and a real affection for Mike in the beginning, right?
Absolutely. It's so the whole, I mean, again, I wouldn't want listeners and viewers to believe that, the way I tell the story is very binary. You have good Mike and bad Arnold and bad Joe. That's totally not it. I mean, I've been told that it's a good book precisely because, like every good novel that you read, things are always a bit more complex than people would think to be from a superficial point of view. And so the relationship with Joe is very, and also the relationship between Joe and Arnold is also very, very complex and multifaceted. And so, yeah, Joe loved Mike. When he saw Mike come onto the bodybuilding stage, into the bodybuilding world, he was like, that is the guy of the future. And so that's why, actually, as I said earlier, the first article, major article about Mike, signed by Armand Tani, is but Mike Menzer, superstar of the future. And they're the one, like Joe and Armand, they're the one who started talking about the thinking man's bodybuilder. That's what Mike was called at the time, as you would remember. They talked about the thinking man's bodybuilder. That's because Joe was really, whatever people want to say about him, how greedy he was or how manipulative he was, whatever, there was one thing about him that was absolutely unquestionable, is how passionate he was about muscle, about bodybuilding, about his sport, not just because of the money he made of it, just because he loved it. He loved it. He grew up, with Eugene Sandow story, the first bodybuilder ever, the Grimek, all these guys. I mean, even Bob Hoffman, he loved Bob Hoffman, even though, they fought. So Joe was passionate about bodybuilding, and he desperately wanted bodybuilding to be taken seriously. Just like Ben, his brother, they were obsessed about getting bodybuilding into the Olympics. Never happened, as you know. And you could wonder why. There's plenty of, especially the new sport, anyway, let's not start that debate now. But so they were really passionate about bodybuilding, and they wanted bodybuilding to be taken seriously. So when Mike comes onto the stage, and he's very articulate, and he has this kind of like very what's the word? Approachable face. You know, like he was very handsome,
Yeah.
very serious, looking very smart, writing very smart, very articulate. They were like, that's the guy that's gonna take, you know, bodybuilding out to the greater world and present it as the great effort and achievement that it is for mankind.
Yeah.
So, and I think also, you know, Joe possibly saw in Mike the son, a son like, or what's the expression in English? A son that he would have liked to have. I'm sorry, I can't find the expression, but you know, there was this kind of like Mike had this very. Even for the 70s, Mike had a kind of like old school look, you know,
Yeah.
like the long hair parted in the middle,
Yeah.
the strong
Okay.
man mustache.
Yeah.
And this is what Joe tried to look like, you know, for many
Oh,
years.
yeah. Okay.
So I think there was kind of like Joe saw in Mike the guy that he would have wanted to be.
To be, okay.
And so after the 1980 Olympia, they remained friends for a while. And Mike started to understand that maybe Joe was not the manipulative guy. Maybe the one who was holding the strings was Arnold, and that Arnold actually, because after the 1980 Olympia, people criticized the results, but they didn't criticize Arnold. They criticized the IFBB and they criticized Joe Wheeler. But no one said, oh my God, Arnold has cheated. They said the IFBB is rotten and, you know, everything needs to change, which they did actually. They had a big conference in Manila the next year, an IFBB international conference with all the IFBBs in the world, where they laid out new rules for judging because everyone was so upset about what had happened. But so in the few months, sorry, after the 1980 Olympia, you know, at first, Mike thinks that Joe is the master of puppets and Arnold is, you know, just one of his puppets. But as time goes, as months go by, Mike starts to realize that actually Joe may be as much a victim as he is of the big master of puppets, which Arnold was. And so actually, Joe asked Mike to write an article called Thanks, Joe, where Mike tells the story of his relationship with Joe. And they were really good friends. Like they will have dinner together. They would, you know, talk about books and philosophy and art, which is something that Joe could never do. Joe never had that kind of relationship with Arnold. He always said that he was always complained that their relationship was kind of like very superficial and very business oriented. But so with Mike, they were really good friends, and then Joe wrote an article about Mike, praising Mike, because Arnold and Franco had started bad-mouthing Mike, saying that he would never have an international physique. So Joe gave Mike a big platform even before the Olympia. Like Mike was writing many articles a month for Muscle Builder and Muscle and Fitness later on. Even when he was not writing the articles, there were pictures of him everywhere. He went on the cover for many, many times. So Joe gave Mike a big platform. And then Joe started promising to Mike the job of editor-in-chief. And it never happened. Mike, you know, was, as you can imagine, very, very disappointed by that. But what I try to explain in the book is that from Joe's perspective, you know, having worked a little bit in media and communication, and I mean, it wouldn't have worked. It was just not possible. Knowing all the controversy around Mike, knowing how Mike was very vocal against the scams of the bodybuilding world, the fake science, you know, it's like Mike was literally the kind of guy who'd write in an article that everyone else's methods were bullshit, that you didn't need to stuff yourself with proteins because the only purpose it has was to make the protein brands richer or corporations richer. You know, so I mean, if you're a director of a magazine, you can't have that guy being editor in chief. You know, it will have
Cultural
meant,
magazine. Yeah.
yeah, it will have become Mike's magazine,
Yeah.
and And Joe was as a businessman, he was smart enough to say, well, wait a second, Mike, people,
Can't go in that direction.
have different ways of training. You're not the only champion on earth. People have achieved great physics with other methods. Why don't we let them speak? And everyone has their own platform and you still be around. But so I think it didn't make, so Mike took it, I think, quite personally, but from Joe's perspective, it made a lot of sense.
Why do you think Mike's magazine didn't work out? The workout magazine. Why do you think it only lasted a couple issues?
No one really knows.
You
I
think it was
think
kind of ahead of its time, maybe? Like you said, it was a precursor for men's health, but do you think it was
I
kind of
think well, it's obvious when you read it. When you read it, it's really obvious how much of a precursor to men's health it is. Not as well done and not as sexy and fun to read. But as I said, the intuition that people want to work out, but they don't all want to look like Tim Belknap or actually even people don't want not everybody wants to look like a bodybuilder. So he had that intuition, and no one else had it at the time. So that's quite something. I think so. He believed that the greater master of puppets was behind the plugging out of his magazine.
Oh, really?
I couldn't find any proof of it. No one could really tell me the exact truth that happened. I was told that some of the people who had invested in it didn't think it was good enough. And it's true that, I mean, it pains me to say that, but the few issues that I've had in hand, they looked a bit amateurish. Is that a word? Yeah. So and also another thing that I invented a scene between an investor and Mike where the guy said, well, we're gonna cut your magazine, we're gonna stop your magazine because it's just not working. And so what the guy's, it's a made-up character, huh? What I put in his mouth, I think is I think a lot of people would agree that it could have been the analysis of a marketing consultant or a communication consultant looking at the magazine, which, by the way, was my job, before I started writing books. I worked in advertising. And so when you look at the magazine, you can easily say how, you can easily understand how it's not really clear where it stands. Like every magazine has their own positioning, and Mike, because that was always his ambition, was, his obsession was what he called the integrated man. So integrated man, it's a noble spirit, noble mind in a noble body, and so he wanted to make an integrated magazine that would talk about all aspects of life, philosophy, training, diet, science, and that type of magazine, it's very hard to achieve because most people, they buy a cooking magazine or they buy a bodybuilding magazine or a sports magazine, but there's very few magazines that manage to talk about everything at once. You know what I mean? I think that might have been a reason. But again, and that's another part of the conversation that I have recreated, I've been told that every issue sold out. So I, you know, if they if it sold out, it means that it worked. So I don't really know. I think it was a little bit of everything. And possibly also Mike's mind was already kind of like falling apart. But definitely the fact that workout stopped definitely was the ultimate blow. So 1980 Olympia, he breaks up with Kathy Gelfo, big love of his life, biggest love of his life. His father dies.
Did she break up with him, Nicholas, or did he break up with her?
I think I've been told that she broke up with him.
She broke up with him.
But I had very little. So I mean, I think I've managed to recreate, and again, from what Dave told me and John told me, The way I talk of their relationship is very close to the truth, but I didn't. She never replied to my email, so I didn't have her own perspective. So I've tried to keep it just as a background story, but it was obviously a very, like Mike repeatedly said that it was the biggest love of his life, and so
Sure.
and the breakup. So that's also why I believe that she broke up, is that he said 20 years later, he said, "I never re really recovered from the breakup." If you
Wow.
say that, it means that you're the one that was dumped, not the dumper. So breakup with Kathy Gaffo, his father dies. He had a financial problem with his accountant, and he had to sell his house in Palm Springs unwillingly. And then workout stops. Yeah, that's a lot for one man,
It was a tragic story of Mike Mentzer. I mean, definitely, like you said, rise to the top and then down,
But that, even the down, even the fall, it's not just like a straight out fall. As I said, he keeps coming back with good ideas that are, then there's
He came
definitely
back with the personal training for a while, before he
Yeah,
passed.
and then he definitely reaches the bottom, with the few years around late 80s, early 90s, where he's institutionalized a few times. There's crazy rumors going around about him. But then he comes back, the Dorian Yates being Mr. Olympia and thanking officially after his second Olympia. I think there's a little short interview of him holding his sando, and he says, "I want to thank Mike Mentzer for da da di da da da." And so all of a sudden, Mike Mentzer comes back as a credible voice in the world of bodybuilding, where he'd been completely trashed and wiped out. And so for a few years, 1992 up until 2001, he manages to, he has this body, he's a consulting, what do you call it?
Personal
Training,
training.
personal training. Courses on the phone, live. So that's where you start. When you go online and you type Mike Mentzer, you see a lot of these guys who trained with him in the late 90s, and they say, "Oh, I met up with him. He was such a good guy, but he smoked terribly of tobacco because he was a good smoker." It's always the same stories. I wanted to dig a little bit deeper, but yeah, I think he was no longer. Yeah, he was just a half of what it was in many ways, but he still had that fire burning.
All right. Well, I'll let you go, Nicholas. It was great talking to you for the last couple hours. And the book is called Mr. America. That's Mister, Mr. America. And I'll have the link below. And congratulations on getting it translated to English and having it in the United States. Can't wait to read the whole thing. Congratulations on putting together such a great novel for your first effort, too.
Thank you, John. It was my pleasure talking to you and sharing those anecdotes. And yeah, I do hope people will enjoy the book. I've tried to make it as thrilling and as I said when we discussed before, it's kind of like a page turner, even though it's 700 pages. Because yeah, I've tried to bring back to life all these years and these greater, bigger than the characters. And anyway, thank you so much. Thanks for
I love how you did it too, making it like a novel instead of just, writing another biography about Mike. That's a really innovative way of doing it, and I think it's going to be really exciting because, like you said, there were so many characters in the bodybuilding world that were larger than life. So it's like a fiction novel in a way,
Yeah, that's what's starting me. I mean, when I discovered the story, I was like, it has all the ingredients of a great Hollywood movie. It was like, so yeah, thank you so much. And à bientôt, as we say in French.
All right. I wish you the best of luck with it, Nicholas. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
All right. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks again to Nicholas Kemla for joining us all the way from France to talk about his new book, Mr. America, the Mike Mentzer novel that he wrote. And I really, again, recommend you guys check it out. I've got the link below in the description, or you can just go on Amazon and look for it. But it's really, really an excellent book. I'm really enjoying reading it. I can't wait to get through the rest of it. All right. Well, I promised you guys these articles. So the first article, this is the first article ever done on Mike Mentzer. This was in the January 1976 issue of Muscle Builder magazine after Mike competed in the 1975 IFBB Mr. America, where he took third place. And they could see that Mike had great potential and was a future superstar. So Armand Tanney did this article. And it says, "I will be as good as Arnold in 1 year," says Mike Mentzer. With his high-intensity training program, he dropped his body weight from 245 to 196 in 5 months to give bodybuilding one of the rarest displays of physical perfection it has seen in ages. He just might do what he says. "I used to do 25 sets of exercises for a body part," declares Mike Mentzer, "but now I have learned how to respond just as well with 5 sets. A statement like that could almost start a religious war. What modern bodybuilder would dare refute the authorized doctrinal standards of bodybuilding? Who would dare challenge the venerable, tried and proven methods of training that vaulted so many men to world bodybuilding titles? It sounds like simple hearsay, except for the fact that the statement comes from a guy who has the lines in development to become a world beater himself. In the main, unheard of until recently, Mike Mentzer became a hit at the 1975 AABA American Bodybuilding Championships. It was his first big contest since 1971 when he won Mr. Pennsylvania. He got third place in his height class against the greats Robbie Robinson and Roger Callard. He displayed a form that put an indelible mark on the minds of all who saw it. Immediately impressed, Judge Bill Pearl, Mr. Universe, said, if he could look as good from the front as he does from the back, he would win any contest. The same could have been said about Steve Reeves, Mike's original inspiration. Mike started bodybuilding in 1951 when he was 12 years old, after seeing pictures of Reeves, who at that time was the Carnite ruler of the bodybuilding world." Actually, Mike was born in 51, so he was 12 in 1963. Mike, with a chest structure similar to his idol, Reeves, reverently seems to have held his chest development to like proportions. Reeves had flat but defined rectangular pecs that in some quarters are still considered the ideal. 1 week after Pearl's statement, Mike erased all doubt by winning the IFBB Junior Mr. America title. Daring to defile the sanctity of a fabled deity and its consummate structure, one would say that Reeves looked very much like Mike Mentzer. Reeves never had a back like Mentzer's. He was somewhat taller, while Mike is medium height, 5'8 and a half. In proportion, Mike has more muscle. He has similar massive shapely calves. Reeves had extreme definition, so does Mike. As Reeves used to, Mike flashes a tense form that displays a deep muscularity as transparent as glass. They both have lost contests. Reeves lost on 2 successive occasions his attempt to win the title he wanted most, Mr. USA. Mike's untested future looks bright. When Gene Mosè, editor of Muscle Builder, listened to Mike tell him about his low-set training program, he said with justified incredulity, "Mike, I think you're putting me on." Mike hastens to qualify his low sets training method. He says that in anything he ever read about Steve Reeves' training, the great one only did 3 sets on any exercise. Although true, Reeves never had attempted to refine his training to the degree that Mike has. Steve based his development on a variety of exercises for a body part. Mike uses 2, perhaps 3 exercises per body part. "The exercise isn't as important as how you do it," he says. "Basic exercises suffice, and he does them in the strictest form, with intense concentration, and he works to failure on each set." Typical of guys who tend to emulate their idols, Mike is one of them who has managed to inadvertently surpass his idol. At the present, he has more muscle than Reeves ever had, mass, density, and definition combined. As for proportion, no one in the game today has better lines. Not many people have seen Mike Mentzer yet. He's due to cause a stir. He has made full use of the valued but largely untried Weider reverse gravity principle. He also employs the Weider force reps principle. Between the two and pairing the number of sets to the barest minimum for each body part, he has seemingly created the most exciting muscle building technique to come along for years. Philadelphia-born Mike did a stint in the Air Force and also pursued pre-medical studies at the University of Maryland. He intends to be a doctor, and he uses his present knowledge of the body to shape his training ideas. By the time he was 15, he learned to train hard, and at 18, he began to seriously compete. In junior high, he was a football and wrestling star, but caught in the grip of bodybuilding, he shelved other sports. The ranks of the physique stars are full of former athletes, champs from other sports. Why did he choose bodybuilding? Mike said he loves the individual feat. It gives him the chance to be the best at something entirely on his own. He doesn't have to share his ability like they do in team sports. Furthermore, he feels he will be the best, a not uncommon spirit among peril-flirting contest bodybuilders. Mike lays down his case with a heavy single stroke. I will be as good as Arnold in 1 year. When he started training seriously again in February of 1975, he weighed 245. He had trained intermittently the previous 4 years. In the July contest, 5 months later, he weighed 196. 2 weeks later, he zoomed up to 215. He apparently is a massive guy with a lot of body tissue who can absorb bulk like a sponge. There are others like that, Steve Davis, Denny Gable. Arnold tends to drop body weight immediately following contests. In any case, the local soda jerks get a forearm workout scooping ice cream for post-contest musclemen. It goes without saying, Mike has correctly evaluated his personal qualifications for becoming a super bodybuilder. First of all, you must have the basic structure. He has that. Next, enthusiasm must exist and persist. Except for a dislocated shoulder that hampered his training a few years ago, he's been excited about training since his father gave him a barbell set for Christmas when he was 12. In the end, it takes intelligence to train right. Mike's system of training proves his resource in taking known principles and applying them experimentally and in a uniquely effective manner. Only a probing intelligence would attempt to shape a workout for contest training from a program of drastically reduced number of sets. He can accomplish with 5 sets what formerly took 20. As a result, he has cut his workouts down to 1.5 hours, covering his entire body. He trains only 3 times a week. He believes that most bodybuilders overtrain. He cites himself as an example. When he first started to get serious about low sets training, he worked out 3 times a week. Encouraged by rapid progress, he stepped it up to 4 times a week. Figuring he had merely gotten a freak initial response with only 3 days, unless he stepped up the frequency, he would continue to backslide. He hastily stepped it up to 5 and then 6 days a week, and his progress almost came to a halt. His enthusiasm faltered also, for him, a bad sign. He admits to a lapse in judgment. He had given in to a common psychological trait that accepts 1 is good, 2 is better, and where 3 of a good thing will kill. He went back to 3 workouts a week, where he remains today, making his phenomenal progress. Recently, he's incorporated 3 or 4 mile jogs in his training. Coupled with an eating program that only permits carbohydrate intake every 3 or 4 days, he has managed to score a heavier definition than ever. He does 8 to 10 reps on practically every exercise. He takes a full body workout each training session, working the sections in the following order. Heaviest muscles first, thighs, calves, back, chest, deltoids, arms, and abdominals. He performs every movement up and down, flexion and extension under controlled conditions. The final 2 or 3 reps of all sets are forced with the aid of a training partner whenever possible. Any action is brought to its fullest extension and flexion. Precision prevails at all times. No movement is lost to momentum or the efficiency of repetitive practice. For example, when he does seated press behind the neck, his partner assists him not only on the final forced reps, but also in applying negative resistance. In this variation of the Weider reverse gravity principle, the partner applies downward manual resistance as the bar is lowered to the shoulders. No part of any movement escapes the pressure of resistance. Every movement is fully utilized. Concentration must be continuous. One can readily understand the enormous amount of work that can be packed into an hour and a half workout. Mike has come to the point where he gets an extreme pump with a single set. With his method of training, the weight practically falls out of his hand by the 10th rep. It becomes an awesome thought working the back, legs, and chest and all in this manner. Mike Mentzer's methods may set a trend in modern bodybuilding. With sheer optimism and enthusiasm, he has cracked a barrier by breaking with tradition. He has reduced 20 sets per body part to 5 sets. He has reduced daily training to 3 times a week. His singular approach is to be supported by a single purpose, to be the best. With his special kind of body, he has an infinite chance to become a superstar. All right. Good article by Gene Mosey. That was the very first article written about Mike Mentzer that introduced him to the bodybuilding world. All right. So I want to read a couple pages from Nicholas Kemla's book, Mr. America. And this is the part of the book where Mike, at I believe he was 14 years old, goes to see his first Mr. Olympia, which was the first Mr. Olympia in 1965 at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. And of course, Larry Scott tore the place down. The place went absolutely crazy for Larry Scott. So I'm going to pick it up right there after Larry Scott gets done posing and what happens with Mike at this contest. Watching all those faces distorted by joy around him in the thunder and tumult of the wild applause had something terrifying to it. But Mike at present is totally enthralled by the spectacle of Larry Scott moving on stage, both a monster and a work of art. In him, he finds again the power and elegance he so much admired in his first picture of Bill Pearl, that first magazine cover that had caught his eye a little over 2 years ago. Just like it had happened with this first contest, and even more so now that he has accumulated hours and hours of reading and training, now he knows, in his body as well as his mind, that the dream he craves is indeed achievable. He feels some kind of immediate connection with Larry, like a call only he could hear. All around him, the crowd wavers and flows in slow motion and gets blurred, and the cries, as if stifled, slowly grow silent. And there is only him and Larry now, and the light from the ramp, which cuts out each of his muscles precisely. And Mike knows that this is his destiny, and this is where he belongs. It's an almost instinctive recognition, like two animals, you and I. We are of the same species and made from the same alloy and cut from the same rock. You don't belong down there amongst all those humans. Those mere mortals. But here on stage with me, on Mount Olympus, with us titans and demigods. Larry leaves the stage, but the roar of the crowd is such that he's forced to come back for a new series of poses that set the roof on fire, as the saying goes. Once, twice, three, four times, Larry performs two more poses and then gives up with a wave of his hand and disappears again. Weider comes on stage, his hair gray and wavy to the ears, perfectly separated midway above his brow, his whiskers neatly trimmed, his three-piece suit a bit too tight. He looks like an illusionist straight out of the 1900s. There is a moment of embarrassment when he puts a toy crown on Larry's head, the first Mr. Olympia, who only keeps it on for two endless seconds, just time enough for the journalist to take a picture that will immortalize him as the King of Muscle, or rather, some will say, the Queen of Kitsch. It doesn't really matter. With or without that stupid crown, in the eyes of all, he looks magnificent. Mike still feels like he's on cloud nine as he walks toward the exit, carried by a crowd so dense that he wonders if his feet are still touching the ground. He exchanges a few words with Russ and Myers. Wow, guys, really thank you. That was great. And then he finds himself outside with the crowd, at once hectic and motionless. Everyone is there, hoping to get a closer look at the evening's champions. Mike can no longer stand still, and the crowd is gradually pushing him away from Russ and Myers, who don't seem to notice. He feels crushed, hampered, swallowed by the multitude, dissolved into its mess, where he knows very well his place is not down here, but up there, there at the top of Mount Olympus, not among these guys with no name or shape, but above the men. So he looks up and spots the fire escapes, and on the second floor, through the illuminated window, he sees shadows move. Russ and Myers have their backs turned, so this must be his moment, right? It's now or never. One must answer the call of fate. In the blink of an eye, Mike grabs the metal bars of the palisade that surrounds the building, and bingo, with one foot resting between two spikes, he pushes himself up on the stairs. All those pull-ups and leg curls of his were not for nothing. And like a cat, in just three jumps, he finds himself in front of the open window, steps over the ledge, and there is in the small neon-lit room with various things spread out on the floor, clothes and shoes and towels and weights. There is a strong, acrid smell of male sweat and the sweet perfume of baby oil before him. Stunned, surprised, amused, and immobile, the two giants descended from Mount Olympus, descended from their podium, and descended from the pages of the magazines hanging on the wall in his garage, Larry Scott and Dave Draper wiping the layers of oil off their bodies with a towel. What are you doing here, champ? Mike feels stupid, but soon regains his confidence. He knows he belongs here, backstage with the two giants. Come on, don't be afraid. We're not going to eat you. I wanted to see you guys from up close. My name is Mike, Mike Mentzer. Mike, huh? But tell us, Mike, how did you get up here? I climbed. The two champions noticed the kid's strong build, the muscular density, the thick bone frame. Good foundations, good potential. I'm from Pennsylvania. I'm training to become Mr. America. Well, you should aim higher now, son. Mr. Olympia is where it's at now. Hey, so welcome to the Champion's Den. Come on in. We'll take you back downstairs as soon as we're dressed. It's mostly Dave doing the talking. Larry is more reserved. Draper jokes about Larry's kitsch Olympia crown and about Weeder, who really did great tonight with his extraordinary event. They laugh together about how wild and heated the atmosphere was, the crazy things that people were throwing at the stage. They talk about Poole and his perfect physique, and little Ricky Wayne, who will go far. That's for sure. To the kids' delight, they show him a few poses, telling him some of their stage secrets. The foot turned like this, the fist turned like that, elbows forward for the famous double biceps so as to get a better spread out on the lats on each side of the chest, like dragon wings. They get dressed. Dave is wearing a short-sleeve Hawaiian shirt, Larry a bland white one, and there goes Mike into the narrow elevator with sliding wrought iron doors sandwiched between the two titans. He climbed up Mount Olympus tonight and rubbed shoulders with the demigods who gave him their blessing. In that elevator, Mike feels like he's coming down back to Earth, imbued with a new power, escorted to his future glory. He sticks out his chest and lifts his chin up as the elevator's door open on the hall and the fans start to scream and shove him off. And he barely has time to shake hands with the two champions and tell them, see you soon. A few hours later, as Mike falls asleep in the pickup truck that brings him back to the religious land of Ephrata, his dreams, powered by the intense and unprecedented experience he's just lived, Draper is trying to get some sleep on a deck chair on the patio of a plush Upper East Side penthouse. It is 3 a.m., yet inside, the after-party is in full swing. The host, an old and wealthy professor, a friend of Joe Weider's, has gathered about 50 people, including a good number of the competitors and winners whose sculptural bodies, barely covered by their summer clothes, circulate happily among the guests. Surrounded by statues and masks brought back now from his travels in South and Africa, the male nudes on the walls next to abstract paintings by the latest trendy artists. They mix with urban and sophisticated crowd of ambassadors, magazine directors looking for new models, doctors known to be generous with anabolic steroid prescriptions, and businessmen, artists, photographers, even a former Black Panther de-radicalized by cocktail parties. Alcohol and Coke are flowing, bodies are touching, the men are whispering in your ear with their breath smelling of vodka and orange juice, and Ricky Wayne, who flew in the day before from London, is staying here with the host, as arranged by Weeder, comes out on the balcony to escape the libidinous gaze of the other guests. The sound of the closing sliding door wakes Draper up, who stands up suddenly and looks at him with a smile. Man, it's a real Babylon in there, Ricky exclaims, leaning against the bay window. Draper rolls his eyes. Well, welcome to New York, son. You mean welcome to the IFBB, more like that. They both burst out laughing. Ricky sits down and tells Draper how the previous night the old professor sneaked into his bed and, not all disconcerted by the young man's refusal to be caressed, offered to put him up and feed him for free in exchange for his services. All you have to do is wear a butler's uniform when I entertain so that all my guests can admire your muscles. Man, let me tell you, I'm getting out of there tomorrow as soon as I can find a flight. Weeder paid for my plane tickets so that I could visit my family in St. Lucia before flying back to London. Oh, he did? Make sure his check doesn't bounce, Draper jokes. New burst of laughter. They swap stories. There's so many about Weeder's legendary stinginess and dishonesty. Ortiz, a Puerto Rican who came in second from last year's Mr. America, had to send his garage friends from Spanish Harlem to recover money that the trainer of champions had owed him for over a year. And Harold Poole, while working in Weeder's warehouses, was paid so little and so rarely that he could barely afford the 2 pounds of red meat he wolfed down every day. But neither Draper nor Ricky have yet to complain about the Padre. He's always been straight with them, and they owe him everything. Young Draper's biceps must have had a particularly nice bulge stretching the sleeves of his shirt, and it must have looked particularly well-defined in the column of sunshine coming down from the skylight above as he turned a box of vitamins to better read the ingredients, the day Joe had spotted him in his New Jersey outlet. That, or maybe it was just his corn-like, all-American blonde hair. Draper had come to the store to buy supplements at a discount since he lived in the neighborhood. He was barely 19 years old, and Weeder immediately saw in him the poster boy for his growing empire. In less than a year, after a few wins and several muscle builder covers, the Titan with surfer boy good looks had become the IFBB's new mascot, the idol of tens of thousands of teenagers. Weider hired him to run the California branch of his business. And there, the New Jersey boy got catapulted onto the beach in Los Angeles and immediately adopted by Hollywood VIPs as one of their own. One day, when a producer was passing through the Santa Monica store, he was struck by the spectacular potential of Day's physique, the almost caricatural beauty of his face, his extraordinary cartoonish musculature. He had immediately felt that the young man could naturally embody and captivate, project, and trigger the imagination and dreams of the new generation. He had offered him to star in David the Gladiator, a show that he had created just for him, and so Draper became a national celebrity, recognized in the street, rubbing elbows with the stars in Beverly Hills, receiving dozens of letters from worshippers begging him to satisfy twisted fantasies that he had never even imagined before, while Weider continued to market him as the super playboy surrounded by pinups on the beach. No one really cared that he was faithfully married, pathologically shy, and couldn't stand on a surfboard to save his life. Suddenly, the tone of the conversation changes. Draper tells Ricky that he never wanted any of this. The fans, the glory, the parties, the fabricated lies. Tonight, Chet Yorton, who came in second, accused the judges of collusion with Weider. He claims that Draper's calves are too thin and that he did not deserve the victory. Dave's annoyed. He feels like an imposter. He who always sees in the mirror the same skinny kid he was before he started lifting weights. He misses his parents, his brothers and sisters, whom he never has time to see. And oh, how he wishes they could have all remained a close-knit family. He does not understand why nor how he gave up the opportunity to pursue a career in a more noble sport like football. He was gifted. With a physique like his, he would have gone very far. Why he chose to sacrifice everything in order to become a muscle freak of over 200 pounds, perhaps it's only because he's always felt the need to be the biggest man in the room, wherever he goes. Well, that's a sick mentality if he ever knew one. He dreams of throwing everything away, of leaving everything behind, of packing up his bare essentials into a suitcase and hitting the road with his wife and little girl. They would travel in his van and ride horses on the plains. They'd school the child themselves. She would learn just as well, wouldn't she? He doesn't know it yet, but the following year, he will sign a contract in Hollywood for Don't Make Waves, the hit comedy of the summer, and he will become even more of a superstar. And then, rather quickly after that, he will sink into alcohol, drugs, and depression before finding God and being born again and recovering much later in the 90s, far too late, years after the wave had receded and died out and bodybuilding had become truly nothing but a freakish and derisory industry working in its own loop. And it will be like that when you wake up with a hangover and the party has ended long ago. He does not know it yet, but in the 21st century, he will write about the lost innocence and simplicity of the 60s. The experience of the 60s was matchless. Sunshine, blue sky, ocean air, Muscle Beach simplicity, Mr. America innocence, Hollywood and Holly Weird. There was no line in the sand. Bodybuilding was like a child sitting at the water's edge, delighted and splashing. It'll just go away, they said. The 60s rolled on. Vietnam, dope, politics, journalism, drugs, greed, power, and evil emerged. The world got smaller. Then as the decade faded to gray, the child got up and walked away. But that night in 1965, on this terrace in the heart of Manhattan, when he just won the Mr. America, there, deep in the New York night, with the yellow lights of the stylish outdoor lanterns and the electric flicker of the skyscrapers glittering around them, and the clinking of champagne glasses and the muffled laughter of the guests behind the window, Ricky could have sworn the blonde bomber was holding back tears. All right, so that was from chapter two in the book Mr. America, written by Nicholas Kemla. And you guys should definitely check this book out. I am only on page 114, and this is a 600-page book. So I can't wait to get into the part where Mike's bodybuilding career starts. And of course, the 1980 Olympia and all those other contests he went in. It should be awesome stuff. All right, guys, that's it for the show this week. I hope you enjoyed our interview with Nicholas Kemla. We'll be back next week with an interview with Bob Chicarillo, the voice of bodybuilding and also a great competitor in his own right. Bob was the Mr. USA winner back in 2000, and he actually started competing back in the 70s like I did. So we're going to talk to Bob Chicarillo about the upcoming Mr. Olympia and also a little bit about his career in bodybuilding. All right, guys, until then, have a great week. Train hard, stay safe, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.